This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Dan Carton with The Times, of course, covers the State House and other governmental news here in Northwest Indiana. And he has been checking in with the legislature since they have just gotten underway on Monday for the short session. And Dan, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Happy to be here.
Well, first, let's take a look at the legislature. That seems to be the big story so far. Well, it's the second big story. We'll cover the big story, which is involving State Senator Eddie Melton in just a moment, but let's talk first about the General Assembly session. How did things get started on Monday when the short session got started? And fill us in on some of the issues that are going to come up here they've already talked about or ones they will be talking about as the weeks go on.
Sure. Like you said, it is the short session, so lawmakers are only going to be meeting at the State House for 10 weeks this year, and then they're actually going to lose a few days because of the Big Ten men's basketball tournament. So it's going to be a short session. It's going to be a fast session. They're going to be done for the year by early March. So there's a lot of work that they want to get done, not much time to get it done in. So it's going to be a rush, and you already saw that on Monday. Usually the first day of session is just a ceremonial meeting. They come in, they file all the bills, and they go off and have dinner. And there was actually on Monday a bunch of committee meetings already, including one focused on one of the top priorities for the House and Senate Republicans and Governor Holcomb to hold harmless teachers from the effects of the new iLearn exam. As you know, the state replaced the iStep exam that it had been using for many years that had been very problematic in terms of scoring and other issues with this iLearn test. And the student results on the iLearn test were, let's say, less than stellar, in part because it's a new test. It's also a new kind of test where it's called computer adaptive. So if the student gets a question wrong, it gives them a slightly easier question to try and get them back on, or if a student gets a question right, it gives them a slightly harder question to see where their true base of knowledge is. So it's been an adjustment.
I would imagine it probably has been a pretty serious one here. In this case here, it's always tough when you've got new software in a computer. You have to learn how to use it, but it's tougher still when you've got teachers and young people who have to learn how to take a new test or administer a new test.
Right. And then when you see that in the scores came back, they were lower than expected. And Indiana has an extremely high-stakes testing system where those student test scores are used for a lot of things, including whether how schools are rated. Every school gets an A through F grade every year, and it also factors into teacher performance evaluations. And a lot of lawmakers agree that those are important things to link to student testing, but they also didn't want to needlessly punish schools and teachers for those results on this first year of tests. So if they had gone forward, about half the schools in the state would have been rated a B or an F based on these test results. And, I mean, practically speaking, saying half the schools in the state are failures going into an election year is not the best strategy, as former State Superintendent Tony Bennett found out when he tried to do that in 2012. So what they're going to do is what they're calling a hold harmless. They're going to take this grade that the schools got in 2017 and 2018, use that for their 2018-19 grade and their 2019-20 grade. And then similarly, they're not going to penalize teachers on their performance evaluations based on student test results, which means teachers will still be eligible for performance pay through these teacher appreciation grants that the state doled out. So the Republican leaders at the State House, who control both chambers, are touting this as their focus on education for this session, and it appears to be on the fast track. It already passed out of committee in the Senate.
Wow.
Yesterday, it was on Monday, it was being heard, so it could be to the floor for a final vote in the Senate, soon in the coming days. And then it could also, it's also a similar measure is also moving through the House. So they're looking to get that done as fast as possible.
What measures that you know of are some of our Northwest Indiana lawmakers working on this time around?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting, interesting session because there isn't much in the way of super specific region proposals like we've seen in past years with the gambling stuff and with the South Shore train stuff. But there are issues. Representative Carolyn Jackson of Hammond is working to come up with a workaround for blocked train or street crossings that are blocked by trains for extended periods of time. Supreme Court said you can't fine them anymore, but she wants to try and sort of encourage them to stop blocking street crossings in a different way. Jim Pressel from Rolling Prairie is Republican. He wants to improve construction in work zones on highways. You know, a few years ago we passed this road funding bill that increased a bunch of taxes to pay for road construction. So you've got this construction all over the place. And Representative Pressel believes people are driving through too fast through those construction zones. So he wants to use automated enforcement cameras there to try and get drivers to slow down.
Mm-hmm. I understand, too, that State Senator Lonnie Randolph, you've had a story on this also in the Times about a bill that he and his South Lake County Republican colleague, Niemeyer, is talking about the bill that they're proposing, and I guess then it'll be in the Senate, and I'm sure there'll probably be an accompanying bill in the Indiana House, where it'll end up going to the House, of course, for review, dealing with safe drinking water for public schools, in particular in Gary and in East Chicago, rather, and in Hammond. So actually, this bill coming up, I guess, is one that would cover all Lake County schools. So there are a number of things that are, I guess, related one way or the other to kids and education, aren't there?
There are. And, you know, underlying all of this is this teacher pay issue that, you know, teachers showed up at the State House on the organizational day for the legislature in November. You know, 150 schools shut down that day so teachers could go to this event to rally for higher pay. And right now it looks like they're not going to get it. And Republican leaders are saying that, you know, they put more money for education in the state budget. Governor has a teacher pay commission that's supposed to report back in 2021 to look at possibilities for increasing teacher pay in the next budget. But it appears that there isn't going to be much happening on teacher pay during this legislative session. So it's going to be up to these teachers to see how they respond to that, because, you know, they showed up in force to make the case for it. Legislators said a lot of nice stuff about teachers on that day, but how will teachers respond when they don't get anything?
No. We're talking with Dan Carton, who covers, among other topics, the state legislature for the Times of Northwest Indiana, and it also covers state government as well, too, and some of the election news that has come out recently, of course, and at least since last October, has been the apparently now ended campaign by Senator Andy Belton to run for governor. You had a chance to speak with him at length, I'm sure, and had an exclusive in the Times about it on Tuesday. Tell us a little bit more about what you learned from Senator Melton and what he's going to be doing now, obviously, other than the General Assembly for the rest of the session.
Yeah, so he is going to stay. He is going to be in the General Assembly for this session, and he is now also planning to run for reelection to his Senate seat. But he is dropping out of the governor's race, which kind of came as a surprise to everybody. Filing for the governor's race and all the races started on Wednesday. And Senator Melton realized on Monday, said on Monday that he just doesn't have, he hasn't been able to raise the money that he thinks is needed to run a successful campaign. He was the third candidate in the Democratic gubernatorial primary. The other two haven't worked in government, really, or haven't been elected to state office, but they've been in this race longer. They seem to have raised more money. Dr. Woody Myers is actually a multimillionaire, so he can draw on his own resources that Senator Melton cannot. So, Senator Melton saying he just hasn't been able to raise the money. He thinks he found a base of support and people who responded to the issues he was talking about, but it just wasn't there for him. So he's going to, he's dropping out of the governor's race. He's going to run again for his Senate seat, which, you know, presumably would position him to potentially run again in the future for a statewide office or anything else.
No. Now, I know in your story, this is run in the Times, you also mentioned, too, about another person who's very interested in this case, because of the fact that Eddie Melton was going to run for governor, decided to be a candidate for governor, that State Representative Reagan Hatcher from Gary was interested in running for Melton's Senate seat, if that came about. And I guess it's going to be interesting to see how all that plays here, if we see some changes there, because Eddie Melton's decided to run for re-election himself.
Right. It really knocked over a bunch of dominoes when he said he was giving up his Senate seat to run for governor. So Reagan Hatcher was going to give up her House seat to run for Senate. A couple of other people who don't hold elective office were going to run for Reagan Hatcher's seat. There was at least one other person looking at running for Senator Melton's seat. And then, you know, that would even further trickle down the line. So I don't know if everybody can just put everything back where it was, or if we're going to get some Democratic primaries in what are normally uncontested seats. Senator Melton and Reagan Hatcher were both kind of gifted their seats by their predecessors in those seats. So, they might find themselves on the receiving end of a primary challenge if somebody's already made some moves to organize a campaign, and they might not want to stand down just because Eddie Melton is going to run for the Senate again.
And I know a question that's come up here just in discussion amongst us here at Lakeshore Public Radio involving Eddie Melton is whatever the chances are that perhaps Eddie Melton might decide to run for Congress, that he could, I guess, become a candidate for the seat that Pete Visclosky is deciding not to seek re-election to. We know that there are a number of other candidates, and most prominently among them, candidates like Hammond Mayor Tom McDermott Jr., and we have people like Township Trustee Frank Mervan Jr., other people like that who are well-known, and maybe Eddie Melton will turn himself into one of these as well, do you think? Is that a possibility now that we know he's not running for governor?
Yeah, it is a possibility. I didn't get the feeling that he was looking that way. He told me that he was definitely running for his Senate seat, not looking at the House race. And, you know, he would face the same challenges that all these people running for the House race have been in it since Congressman Visclosky said a few months ago that he wouldn't run. So they're, you know, several hundred thousand dollars ahead of wherever Senator Melton would be, starting at zero. And it's a lot harder to raise federal dollars. There's different rules. There's different limits. It's a lot easier to raise money for state races in Indiana because it's basically a free-for-all when it comes to campaign finance. So I think that would be a big hurdle for him to overcome to run for that congressional seat. But I wouldn't, you know, put it out of the question. At some point in the future, anybody elected to that Senate seat serves a four-year term, so they can kind of take a free shot in the off year at any other office that's open. You see this with Senator Karen Tellian and Ogden Dunes, who's running for Attorney General.
That's right. That's right.
She can hang on to her Senate seat either way. And, you know, same with Mayor McDermott. You know, he's going to, if he runs for Congress and loses, he's still going to be mayor of Hammond for another 4 years. So I wouldn't write Eddie Melton's political obituary quite yet.
That would say so. Well, you know, it's not even been a month when we last talked about gambling in Northwest Indiana. And you had one of the stories in the Times here about sports wagering in particular. What did you determine? And we know the governor put down a $10 bet, I guess, back in September on the Colts to win the Super Bowl. And I guess he's not upset the fact that even though he didn't lose the money that he didn't lose altogether, too. I guess it's sports wagering is doing very, very well in Indiana these days, I understand.
It is. It is. And sort of shows the fiscal conservatism because Mayor McDermott put down a $100 bet on the Bears to win the Super Bowl, and he also lost that money. So, between the start of sports wagering in September and then through the last reporting period at the end of November, Indiana, there's been $273 million bet on sporting events in Indiana. And that amount has been growing month by month as more people, you know, learn that this is available and learn how to do it. And then also as more online vendors come on, Indiana has a sort of an interesting situation where you can go to a casino and place a sports wager in person with a person or at a kiosk at the casino. But there's also several vendors that are licensed or associated with local casinos that you can just bet on your phone. You can pull out your phone right now, while we're talking and place a bet on the Super Bowl or NFL playoffs or NBA game or anything else. And you can do it from your house or wherever you are. So it's really making, you know, sports betting convenient to the people who want to do it wherever they are, 24 hours a day.
Now, do you think this will make an advantage to folks who stay in Northwest Indiana? That is, they will actually go to the casinos in Gary or Hammond or East Chicago and be able to do so as opposed to doing it at home? Or do you think that maybe it'll be still keep attracting folks from Illinois? Because we know that Illinois has approved the same sort of deal, but they haven't worked all the details out yet.
Yeah, I think the region casinos are definitely benefiting from Illinois dragging their feet on this. Illinois passed it a couple months after Indiana did, but they've been extremely slow to roll out the regulations. Illinois also isn't going to allow betting on Illinois college sports in Illinois. So if you want to place a bet on Northwestern or DePaul basketball or U of I football, you're going to have to come to Indiana or another state to do it. And just even the difference, even within Indiana, though, you're going to see some people gravitating towards the casinos, even though it is possible to do just on your phone. It's a unique experience. You're surrounded by a bunch of other sports fans. They've got big comfy chairs at a lot of these places. They've got food that they can, you know, bring to your chair or bring to a table. You can just sit there and watch the game and, you know, go up and place a bet. And, you know, as we get closer to the Super Bowl, you're going to start hearing more about the prop bets where you can, you know, bet on the outcome of a single play or bet on, you know, who's going, how long the national anthem's going to go. And it's a cool experience to be at a casino and surrounded by people who are winning or people who are losing and people who are cheering and just enjoying sports. If you're a sports fan, this is something that really appeals to a lot of them.
Well, Dan, we appreciate you taking time to talk about the stories about sports wagering and about Eddie Melton's decision to not to be in the gubernatorial race any longer, as well as what's happening at the General Assembly as the session gets underway. And on that note, of course, we'll be checking back in later to see what other stories that you have out there as well. And thanks for spending time with us to talk about it today.
Sounds great. Thanks.
Dan Carton covers the State House and state government and local government, too, for the Times of Northwest Indiana. On this Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's find out some of the latest news out of the city of Gary as well as Lake Station. Let's check in with Carol Carlson, who's reporter for the Post-Tribune, on the stories that she has put out in print and online. And Carol, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Hi, Chris.
Well, how are you today?
I'm pretty good.
That's good. One of the great stories that you had out is a way to take a look at the changing of the guard. And the story we're talking in reference to is the story about the changing of the guard in government in the city of Gary, as we have a new mayor who has been installed into office. And you had a chance to talk with the parting mayor, who is very busy in her own right now with a new job. Tell us what we had to say about Karen Freeman Wilson as she takes a look at the time that she spent in office as mayor.
The former mayor reflected with me for a little bit on her during her last week in office, and of course, it's bittersweet since she was defeated in the primary. She was seeking a third term, but that was not meant to be for her. So she talked a little bit about her accomplishments and her disappointments. The largest disappointment being a failure to make a serious headway on the city's crime issues.
That's going to be really tough, I think, for anybody. You have only so much, I guess, you can control and do with whatever you can. As far as the administration's concerned, you can, I guess, help the police department as much as you can, but that's only going to go so far, I would imagine.
Well, as she said, there is no silver bullet. And, you know, we certainly learned fairly quick that the homicides don't stop just because there's a new mayor. There's already been two in the young year. It will take a downturn this year.
I know that she spent a lot of time in her reflections, and you had in your report as well, too, about economic issues. It's no surprise that that would be, besides crime, one of the other big issues that folks in the city of Gary have faced has been the economy and how it's affected jobs and the businesses and industry in Gary. had a chance to talk with her, I guess, when finding out, I guess, what, looking back at all the time that she's had in office from, I guess, going back to her very first State of the City address back in 2012, how does she seem to think about what she's been able to do in carrying the city government along, even with all the ups and downs of the budgets and the economy?
Yeah, Gary, of course, was hit particularly bad because of the state tax caps and the disinvestment in the city and population decline. I believe it was probably worse than what she anticipated. She came into office already knowing that she was going to be facing a budget deficit. So a lot of her efforts were put onto the economic development side, and she certainly made some headway there. I mean, there's going to be an inland casino for the first time, and they did broker a new agreement with U.S. Steel, which promised to make significant investments in their flagship mill, and they also provided some upfront money for the city and for the school district and the library system. So there were certainly some accomplishments along the way for her.
I know, too, that one of the other things that she has fought so much about and know everybody knows about, it's been very, very well publicized. We've done our share of it, as well as you have in your stories, is talking about the blight and the decay of this of the buildings in this particular city because of the economy and turn people leaving, moving to other communities here in Northwest Indiana. And I know that she worked so hard to try to help fight the blight and bringing organizations in and some innovative ways to deal with all of the abandoned houses and the like.
She started, of course, the neighborhood block clubs, and they called it a 4x4. They would go and clean four blocks in certain neighborhoods during the weekends. And as far as blight, she was able to, of course, they had the horrible tragedy with the serial killer who was dumping women's bodies in abandoned Gary houses. And about the same time, the city was collaborating with the University of Chicago and starting to get a handle on just the extent of the number of vacant houses, and the students at the University of Chicago in this master's public government program did the survey, and they came up with the number of about 6,500 vacant buildings, and they were able to use that to gain federal funding to start demolition on some of those. And I think that the mayor said they've done about 1,500 so far, something to that extent. So there has been some headway made.
I know that the city had worked very hard in getting support from outside the community. You mentioned about some of the organizations that helped set up programs and like. We know, of course, Steel City Salvage is the way that they try to take an innovative way to be able to repurpose some of the material that might have been taken down from some of these houses and the like, and give them another life in some other form, maybe available for people to put in as they do remodeling in their own houses, too. And we know the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation can't be ruled out as well, too, as being a big factor in the city of Gary while Mayor Freeman Wilson's office.
At the Knight Foundation, as well as Michael Bloomberg, mm-hmm. who the former mayor has endorsed, in fact, to be in his presidential run, he gave over $1 million to create that art house social kitchen on Fifth Avenue. The Knight Foundation is invested in Gary. They used to own a newspaper in Gary called the Post Tribune, and they have kept their foundation's eye on their legacy newspapers, even though Knight Ritter as a newspaper organization doesn't exist anymore.
One of the things that you mentioned in your story, in particular when you had a chance to talk with Mayor Freeman Wilson, is the fact that she's been able not only to do what she can in the city of Gary, but she's also done some ambassadorship, I suppose, for the city of Gary outside. And one job in particular that she took on and got caught some flack for that, I suppose, was when she was put into a leadership post with the National League of Cities.
Yeah, this past year she has served as the president of the National League of Cities, and as such, of course, that involves a good deal of travel and time outside of the city, which she did catch flack for, but she also made connections during that during that period, which helped the city and possibly bring, you know, an attempt to bring new money into the city and collaborate with other mayors and see what's working in their cities and on the economy front, on the crime front, and other issues.
We should also mention, too, the fact that she has gone from being the mayor of Gary into a very important Northwest Indiana and regional job, even Chicagoland, I suppose. Tell us briefly what she's taken on now that she's left City Hall.
Yeah, she's currently the CEO of the Chicago Urban League, and she'll be staying in the arena of service and different type of arena, not as political, although I don't know that much about the Chicago Urban League, but won't be as obviously political as being the mayor of Gary.
One of the other things that you had out there in print and online as well in the stories about the changes in the guard in the city government here in Northwest Indiana is the story that you wrote up about being able to attend the swearing-in ceremony for a new Lake Station mayor. Tell us a little bit about Bill Carroll, why he is so unique as far as being a chief executive in a community like Lake Station and what kinds of things he has planned for his city.
Well, Bill Carroll is Lake Station's new mayor. He replaced Chris Anderson, who decided not to run again after one term. And Bill came to Lake Station only about 5 or 6 years ago, and he was not involved in politics. But when he moved to Lake Station, he became involved in community organizations, and he was the manager of the Ace Hardware store in Lake Station on Central Avenue. Bill is also gay, and he and his partner didn't hide it. They weren't in the closet, and they campaigned together, and he did win the support of Chris Anderson and most of the Democratic Party in Lake Station, and he won pretty easily in the primary and won even easier in the general election in November.
What kind of reaction, and you've had a chance to be able to follow the campaign through this past year, from the primaries up through the general election, and had a chance to talk with people in Lake Station about it. What have been the average residents' view, any views at all about this person who wants to run for mayor and the fellow who was elected mayor?
There was some concern. I don't know if concern would be the right word, but there was some concern on the part of Bill's mother, who thought that he might be facing some unwarranted criticism because of his lifestyle, sexual orientation choice. In the city, it was fairly quiet. There were some signs that got defaced during the primary. Social media, you know, how that can be. There were some comments there, but overall, it was fairly quiet, I guess, and he's kind of flown under the radar. He is the first gay mayor in Northwest Indiana. Of course, he's not the first one in Indiana because the mayor in South Bend is.
Yeah, we know Pete Buttigieg. he got that distinction to be sure. So
yeah.
Well, we're wishing the best for Mr. Carroll and his new administration. He has some good things, I guess, that are going to go for him, some improvements and the like that are going to happen in Lake Station, certainly with this year that's underway now. One last story, Carol, I wanted you to, if you would talk about it here, in fact, the story is just out in today's paper and online, is being attend the Gary Homicide Victims Vigil that happened yesterday during the midday. Tell us about that vigil, some of the reasons behind asking for public support for a problem, and it goes back to the problem of crime in Gary.
Yeah, that vigil was organized by Minister Marvin East, and he was called by some neighborhood folks in the area of Harrison Street, 19th and Harrison. That's been that neighborhood's been plagued by homicides in recent years. And on Monday, a man named Wendallis Tobar Jr. was shot and killed just in the 600 block of 19th Avenue. And as a result, neighbors were telling Minister East that they were frightened and afraid to go outside, and he was alarmed at the numbers of homicide victims in Gary last year. So he organized this vigil that was held yesterday, and it drew some of the family members of Wynn Dallas and others who are concerned about violence in Gary.
Yeah, I was going to say that the neighbors in that particular region there are very, very concerned. And even though there are problems, there's an abandoned, closed and abandoned school that's in the neighborhood. In fact, I know that was also the site where they found one of last year's homicide victims. So there are all kinds of reasons for residents in that particular area to be concerned.
Yeah, just a few blocks north of where we were yesterday was, of course, where the body of the Portage woman was found back in November.
Mm-hmm.
She had been killed in Portage, but her killers dumped her body in the gymnasium at the abandoned, closed Norton Elementary School.
Well, Carol, we appreciate you taking time to talk about these stories that you've had, including the latest one that's in today's paper about the gun violence vigil in the city of Gary, and the other great stories that kind of come out of the 2019 election, the results, and we hope to have you back on again, talk about the next set of stories that you'll have out in the Post Tribune real soon.
Thanks very much, Chris.
You're welcome. Carol Carlson is a reporter for the Post Tribune, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking. It's time once again for another edition of Inside Indiana Business Insiders, the group of people coming in to speak with Inside Indiana Business host Gary Dick, and get some perspective on some of the week's top stories. This week, they're taking a look back at 2019 and also ahead on how the Hoosier State's economic landscape will be shaping up going into the new year. This week's panel is a Hollowell Consulting President, Jennifer Hollowell, IndyPolitics.org publisher, and also he's a local talk show host, Abdul Hakim Shabazz, and the director of the Ball State University Center for Business and Economic Affairs, Michael Hick.
This week, we're taking a look back at 2019 and also ahead to how the state's economy, the economic landscape may be shaping up for 2020 as we head into this new year. Welcome one and all to the Insiders. As we look back and also look ahead to the year ahead, and Mike, we touched on this in our top story this week with you, but as you look back on 2019, what kind of a year was it? How would you characterize the year for the Indiana economy?
Well, I think the best way to think about it is to look back over a decade. 2019 capped a decade of economic growth. We've never had that before, not since we kept records in the 1830s, 1840s. And so here's a period of time that the Indiana economy expanded, added almost 500,000 new jobs over that time period, really made substantial improvements from the deep recession. And so maybe slowing a little bit with an unemployment rate that's still fabulous, and then wage growth. So setting the stage for the future with maybe some optimism, but some, you know, warning signs maybe as well after a good solid decade.
Yeah, a lot of jobs announcements too, really for the past several years. And Jennifer, we were talking about international investment, Infosys and others making substantial investment and job commitments in Indiana.
Yeah, the international investment has grown 300% in the last 2 years in Indiana. And then talking about job growth, advanced manufacturing, life sciences, and the tech industry, with Infosys, story started before now, but expected to bring in 3,000 jobs by 2023. And then we have all kinds of growth in the tech sector across the state. And I think that's really a good story for how the growth will fold over the next few years and bring talent to the state as well.
Abdul, as you look at the big year, from your perspective, the big storyline from last year, from 2019.
What was interesting about Indiana was the fact that if you go back, you know, trying to piggyback on Mike's thing at the start of the decade, you know, the situation our economy is in, just struggling, trying to get back on its feet. Now we have worker shortages almost literally across the state of Indiana. I mean, when I saw a thing on social media about Aldi's hiring, warehouse workers for $20 an hour, no post-secondary education because they're just that hurting for the workforce. And even more when you get, like Jim would tell you, in the tech trade and that skilled workforce. I think to me, that's the big economic impact. And what do we do, about all these unfilled positions and the fact that we have so many Hoosiers that just aren't qualified to fill those spots?
Yeah, and Mike, transitioning from 2019 to 2020, because workforce will continue to be a big issue. But one thing you mentioned that really caught my attention is income growth, because that's been a huge challenge for Indiana. but we've seen some positive uptick in that regard.
Right, at least the last few months. Yeah. So if there's a down story of the last 10 years, it's the employment growth has really been concentrated in those low-wage sectors, low-skilled workers. But maybe now we're beginning to see job growth that is accompanied by wage growth, and that sets us up for a better year, less stagnant economic growth that accompanies the jobs that we've been growing. So even if we have a slow growth year in terms of total employment because we're just out of people, maybe we'll see a little bit better economic growth with that income across the board. Mm-hmm.
As we look at those storylines for 2020, I think, and Mike, you mentioned this earlier, talent, Indiana keeping talent, attracting talent here is a big one. Jennifer, I know you work with a lot of tech companies, the tech industry. How's that all shaping up as we get into 2020, quality of life improvements and all the things that communities are doing, trying to make themselves more attractive mm-hmm. to talent?
Well, and that's part of where I think the state has to shift some. We've become the low-tax state. You know, we're great for business. Regulation, all those sorts of things. We're in the top. Where we're not always getting that is the quality of place, the amenities that attract people here. And Abdul mentioned on any given day, you know, there are a couple of thousand tech jobs that are unfilled because we don't have the people to fill them. So we either need to have programs geared toward training people here who can do that, but we also need to recruit people from the coast to fill these jobs.
As one element I wanted to ask you about is the creation of the Indiana Destination Development Corporation. Elaine Beadle, former president at the Indiana Economic Development Corporation, tapped to head that up. But this is an effort that's going to focus on tourism, but also telling the Indiana story to try to attract that talent here.
That's right. I think part of the focus of it is to make it a destination in lots of ways. And up until this point, I don't think any agency or person in the state was responsible for bringing people here outside of tourism, but we need talent here. I mean, the future of the state and to be able to hit our revenue numbers to do the things we need to do in state services, we need bodies. Mm-hmm. And so we're very hopeful that with Elaine leading this new effort and the state kind of rethinking branding and marketing beyond just tourism will be really helpful to providing the workforce that we need.
Well, the old slogan used to be, it's a nice place to visit, but you wouldn't want to live there. And so I think what Indiana's going to have to do is, hey, not only are we a great place to visit, but it's a place where you want to live, you know, relocate your family. I mean, you think about, you know, just look at housing costs, you know, San Francisco, New York City, and how much more your dollar gets you here, you know, in central Indiana, not to mention a little bit the further you go out. So I do think, you know, attracting that talent, saying, hey, not only is Indiana, you know, are the people great, it's a great place to live, and your money goes a whole lot further.
Mm-hmm. Mike, do you think this is a good approach? We were talking off camera that some other states have kind of cut out the public funding of tourism efforts. This kind of quasi-public, public-private partnership, the way to go in your view?
Now, much like what IEDC was mm-hmm. more than right. a decade ago, this is what other states are looking to. So the Pure Michigan program is gone. The legislature canceled it. The governor vetoed an effort to revive it. And I think they're spending $60 million to tell their story about Michigan. And we're going to spend $1.5 million and a lot of private sector dollars to do the same thing. And I think it's right. The best important part of this is not going to be attracting more conventions to Indianapolis. We're going to fill these hotels. It's going to be people to hearing stories about Indiana that says, yeah, that's a place I could live. Because there's a lot of good in the state, a lot of opportunity for new population growth, mm-hmm. which is the key to the next decade.
As you look at regional economies around the state, and Mike, I'll ask you, anybody can jump in on this, but what regional economy? Fort Wayne, Northeast Indiana has been a lot of activity in downtown Fort Wayne and that region on the talent side doing a lot of things. Any particular region that impresses you or stands out to you as really getting some things done and poised for growth?
Right. I think, well, obviously Central Indiana is just sucking up population from around the state. But if you look at the greater Louisville area, now that there's access to that part of Indiana to downtown Louisville because of the bridges, the extraordinary amount of regional cities development that's happening in the three regions, Evansville, Fort Wayne, and then the North Central area, are really doing very well. I think are places that could get to national growth levels over the next decade.
Something I've noticed, this is from practicing law, a lot of some of the smaller communities here in Indiana, just about everybody has taken some sort of plan to rehab, to redevelop, to reinvigorate their downtown areas, whether it's Martinsville's, the Terre Haute's of this world, places that used to be sort of boxed and boarded up, are now slowly but surely starting to come back to life. That shows a lot of the state's mayors say, hey, you know, we need that quality of life, once again, like Jen said, to attract that talent, and that's what they're doing by sort of revitalizing and reinvigorating their downtown areas.
Flaherty and Collins, Indianapolis-based developer, Darren Kittner was on the show earlier in this program and talked about how they're investing the Arbuckle as a $40 million kind of a luxury development in Brownsburg. They're doing projects in Kokomo, in New Albany, in Mishawaka, in places all over the state, and again, really kind of focused on the talent attraction thing, which gets across sectors, but in particular in technology.
Yeah, well, and it's important. It's important that they're doing that because we have to create these spaces, and we do see, because of regional cities and other things, that some of these communities are working together more. I think that that is going to be the new trend that we see the state going in, that we need this regional collaboration. It doesn't have to end at city limits, mm-hmm. because to create the environment that people want to come in and fill the jobs and work in these places, that's the kind of coordination that we need to see.
Just starting out the new year, 2020, but in terms of the big storyline you think that's going to make headlines in 2020, what would it be?
Every time I think about the election, I think about how my home state of Illinois just legalized marijuana. I need to go back home because, it's going to be the election. It's going to permeate everything. It's regulatory policy. It's tax policy. It's our foreign policy. The election, Donald Trump, the president, that's going to be the 800-pound gorilla in the room.
Yep. Jennifer.
Yeah, I think it is, too. It's going to impact all the issues and the way businesses conduct themselves and what happens in state government. Between us having the vice president and Mayor Pete from South Bend, Indiana is going to be a hot topic and a lot of focus here. We also have congressional races, the attorney general's race. There's going to be a lot of focus, and it's going to suck up a lot of the oxygen.
Yep. Give you the last word, Mike.
I agree. The Midwest economy, the states mm-hmm. that were so important in the 2016 election, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana, have had the worst growth over the past 3 years. And so we're going to see some surprising things happen, a lot of presidential attention over the next 12 months here in the Midwest.
Mike Hicks, Jennifer Hollowell, Abdul Hakeem Shabazz, thanks for some great perspective on 2019 and also looking ahead as well.
Inside Indiana Business is Indiana's only statewide business program. You can go online at insideindianabusiness.com and check out this program or go on to Inside Indiana Business's YouTube channel. We talked recently with Northwest Indiana Forum Executive Director Heather Ennis about the events that happened in 2019 and a look ahead to 2020. Tell us more about how 2019 seems to have shaped up for the forum and certainly for all of the members of the organizations that help make up the forum.
Certainly. So it's been a very exciting year for Northwest Indiana. And this year, the forum teamed up with the Indiana Economic Development Corporation. And we did 24 outbound trips talking about Northwest Indiana with our local economic development organization partners, as well as the IEDC, NIPSCO, and others. We traveled all around the country and told the story of Northwest Indiana. We got an opportunity to meet with over 400 site selectors, companies, and brokers to tell the story, all around the country, as well as we made a trip to Canada as well. So Virginia, North Carolina, New York, Colorado, Seattle, Washington. So really traverse the map. So
I know one of the areas in particular that you focus on is, of course, not only stimulating business to bringing people that and organizations that maybe are not all that familiar with Northwest Indiana within Northwest Indiana becoming members of the community, so to speak, but also you talk too about expanding jobs. How does the forum fit into all of these different segments? And I guess maybe that's all part of this overall plan that has come out, and we've talked about before, about the program, which is called Ignite the Region.
Yeah, so Ignite the Region, our strategy for economic transformation is alive and well. So we kicked that off in 2018 and spent 2019 continuing that collaboration and working on implementation and transformation. There are about 123 initiatives on the Ignite the Region implementation matrix. We've got 112 of those that are currently in process, and 22% of them being completed. So it's pretty exciting. We're seeing things come not only get started, and the organizations around the region working hard together to get things done, but actually getting things done and moving things forward. We're really excited about the entrepreneurship and innovation team is working on an implementation of Impact Labs, which will be for not only for entrepreneurship, but intrapreneurship, as you were talking about, Chris, seeing the companies that are here grow, and so helping companies that are here be more innovative and figuring out how to remain relevant in their marketplace. So we're excited about that partnership. We're working with Center of Workforce Innovation on a 21st century talent region and really putting some numbers to the implementation matrix and what targets we're trying to hit. So it's been fun, a whirlwind of a year in 2019.
When you talk about some of the components that go into the Ignite the Region program, the multi-pronged approach, as I know that you all call it there at the forum, you talk about topics like infrastructure and placemaking. We've talked about some of the other major points about business development and entrepreneurship and talent in particular. That's where you're trying to get the Center for Workforce Innovations and be able to get them involved in bringing more jobs into the region, getting more people being able to be ready for those jobs. Where does infrastructure fit into the picture?
So obviously we have to have strong infrastructure in order for companies that are here to grow, as well as to be able to attract companies. So there's very exciting things happening around the infrastructure at the port in Burns Harbor. We're seeing exciting developments and prospects that are continuously looking at the Gary Chicago Airport and the other airports that we have in the region. The rail infrastructure is a critical asset to the industrial development that looks at our region, and continues to grow here. So we try and keep a close eye on all of those things and make sure that we're aligning our resources to be best used for what we want our economic future to look like here in the region.
One of the things that gets brought up all the time, I'm sure, and you all cover it, and people, when you talk with folks outside Northwest Indiana, and if they're even remotely familiar with Northwest Indiana, about the great industrial legacy that we have, is on the other side of that industrial legacy is the environmental problems that come with all the heavy industry that we have had in the region. We've shed many of them, but of course, a lot of it's changing because of the changes in the 21st century. But how does the forum fit in with trying to help revive some of these areas that used to be heavy industry into places that people can in turn use again with other types of business? And a lot of these, we've talked before about brownfields. How does this all fit into what's been done in 2019 and what you're hoping to do next year?
Yeah, so we were the recipient of an EPA grant this past year, along with our partners of NERPC and the Regional Development Authority. We jointly applied for funds from the EPA and have been awarded a grant to be able to help revitalize some of those properties. One of the largest problems for attracting investment to Northwest Indiana is that we don't have enough product ready. And so being able to redevelop those brownfields and remediate those properties to get them back on the tax rolls and get them cleaned up and better for the entire environment is a critical component for our success moving forward as a region.
What kind of input do you get from not only the businesses and the industries here in Northwest Indiana, but other organizations outside the region that maybe are interested in locating some type of business here, whether it's just a small outpost, so to speak, or a full-fledged factory? What kind of things do you hear from these people who want to maybe have a say in what the Northwest Indiana of the future is going to look like?
You know, it's so exciting. We spent some time in Seattle, as I said, at a tax preparedness conference, and different states got to give presentations to these tax incentive specialists that work with companies that are looking to locate in a certain area, or work directly for the company. You know, there are representatives there that are directly aligned with companies such as Honda or Lockheed Martin was there. So there were tax specialists, and as the states were talking, there was a site selector that was in the Michigan state presentation and kept referring to that it was a competition between Michigan and Indiana for this project. And the site selector kept referring to how competitive Indiana was for the project throughout the Michigan presentation. I felt a little bit badly for the Michigan folks, but it was really exciting to see that people are getting the story. People are understanding the opportunities for Indiana and how great our tax climate is and how wonderful our assets are. And then they continuously referred to Northwest Indiana and the infrastructure and what that means from a competitive standpoint for business. It turned out that Michigan ended up doing something extraordinary to close the deal, but it was kind of fun to listen to folks out from outside of the region during a presentation about another state talking about how awesome Indiana is. So the message is getting out there, and people are starting to realize that we've got great workers, great opportunity here in the region. You know, as the heart of the Midwest, we really have an awful lot to offer, and we truly are the middle of everywhere. You know, our proximity to the East Coast is easy. The Great Lakes offer us great proximity to the world, and so we're really very fortunate where we're at.
I know you spent a lot of time in 2019 following through and fine-tuning the Ignite the Region initiative. What kind of goals does the Northwest Indiana Forum have for 2020?
So 2020 is going to be another exciting year. As I said, we did 24 trips this year going out and telling the story. We've got 42 active projects. We'd like that number for 2020 to be 50 active projects that we tackle for 2020. Again, we'll probably have somewhere in the 20 to 25 outbound trips where we work with partners to go out and tell the story of the region. We hosted 19 networking events here in the region. We'd like to do the same in 2020. I think that, you know, we're really seeing things come to fruition from the Ignite the Region plan, and really being able to put some more dollars towards those projects and to be able to raise funds for the things that are highest on the priority list there will be.
That's Northwest Indiana Forum Executive Director Heather Ennis from our conversation earlier. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. Our thanks to Dan Carton of The Times and Carol Carlson from the Post Tribune and to Gary Dick with Inside Indiana Business. And thank you for joining us. We'll be back with you with the more Regionally Speaking programs on Monday here on Lakeshore Public Radio.